Otto Onion. As the head of Revolut Audi F1, you must be thrilled to finally launch your 2026 car.
Yeah? This is the culmination of a huge amount of very diligent, careful, detailed analysis of what it takes to win in Grand Prix racing. And so that is what we have put on the car.
And what is that?
McLaren Orange and Mercedes Silver. Win-win.
Hello and welcome to Gareth Jones on Speed. I'm Gareth. Joining us later on will be Alex Goy, but right now, he's Zog.
Hello.
How you doing?
Getting by. How you doing today?
I'm good. I've got these sort of markers in my year. We all have them, you know, birthday, Christmas, the gathering, which is a thing that I do for the Alarm. I host their sort of fans convention, and the band plays two gigs over the weekend, and I do lots of interviews and stuff. That was happening this last weekend for the first time without Mike Peters.
Of course, yeah.
It was very emotional, but still utterly fantastic. But excellent. This isn't the place to discuss that, but that's one of my markers. And the other one is the launch of the new Formula One cars as it begins before the start of the season.
Which has been happening in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, we're getting little dribbles of information, a strip tease of what's to come. I kind of like it because some teams...
A tease rather than a strip tease. I see tease here. I see no strip tease.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. Well, I'm going for the complete reveal. Yep. That's a strip, okay. Isn't it? But it's like the elephant in the cupboard, isn't it? We're seeing little bits at the time.
Just carry on. let's not pick apart these metaphors. Too.
Elephant in the box, isn't it? That's what it is. You see a trunk and you think, oh, it might be a snake. And you see a leg and you think, oh, it might be a tree. And you feel the tail and you think, oh, it might be a rhino. But unless you see the whole thing, you don't know it's an elephant. Do you know that metaphor?
I do, but I think what you said before, look, just carry on. Let's move on because we're going to get horribly bogged down in this.
I've got all the time in the world for that, but maybe this program hasn't. So, yeah, here we are at the launch of all the cars. We're getting little sneaks of what's to come. And there's another launch we have to discuss, Sog. First, right, Artemis 2.
Ah, yes, which is coming up February the 9th, I think, is the date they've set for it. Going back to the moon. Wow.
Super wow. Yeah.
But also, what's going on? Because the plan to put American astronauts on the moon has been evolving, changing, you know, over the years since they decided they were going to go back. And at some point, it's been an all NASA effort. Yeah. And at other points, there's been a lot more involvement with SpaceX and a much greater inclusion of SpaceX hardware in the plans, which, you know, might have seemed like a good idea, but might seem a bit sketchier now, given how SpaceX seemed to be developing Starship. And right now, it seems kind of unclear how the path beyond this mission goes. Because, yeah, this mission is going to send astronauts to orbit the moon and come back. No landing.
Yeah, it's Apollo 8 again.
And the landing bit is a trickier part of the whole procedure, and one that, yeah, we don't know how they're going to do that yet. Exactly what's going to take them there? Will they be refueling along the way? Yeah, there are a lot of unknowns in this, a lot more unknowns than you'd want in a program to put people back on the moon.
Yeah, agreed. When the Apollo program did it in the late 60s, the lunar module, the command module, the service module, and the Saturn V were bespoke devices built, designed, and rigorously tested. Remember, Apollo 9 and Apollo 10 both tested the lunar module before they attempted a landing with it. And what you have is this sort of slightly even more modular, broken-up program where they're going to have to adapt the version 3 of the Starship that is being developed now to become an efficient, effective moon lander. It doesn't look like the right vehicle to me. I think the Blue Origin Blue Moon lander, which has also been developed, but again, untested, if you want to get things done in a hurry, that's the one to use. The Starship may be great medium term and long term, but it's not going to get to the moon before China does.
I'm sure you're right about that. Yeah, 100%. And I think China will have a successful crewed mission to the moon before America, I
they
think.
Will.
You know, there will be Chinese boots on the moon before there are American boots on the moon again. I think that's likely. But we'll see. But it is exciting.
Yeah.
I can't wait to see the launch next week. Yeah, it'll be a blast, quite literally.
Yeah. I love a live manned launch. Sorry. I love a live crewed launch.
Yep.
Because, of course, there are four people on board this spacecraft. One is a person of colour and one is a person of woman. I think that's the correct way to say it these days.
Good luck to them all. I hope they have a great time.
Yeah.
What fun. Get to go and have a look at the moon, have a little twirl around it, come on back. Oh, that's fantastic.
Listen, you know, I'm not a religious man in any way. Like you, I'm a man of science. But when I was a kid, I was, 7 years old when Apollo 8 happened. And I remember Jim Lovell reading from Genesis as they orbited the moon on Christmas Eve. And it was just ethereal, the whole thing. And like I said, I'm not a religious man, but I was brought up in a very religious community. My mother was my Sunday school teacher. So I was asked to say something in chapel. And so I just said, well, you know, I'm going to read from Genesis like the guys from the Apollo 8, you know, I took it back to science. I managed to steal it away from God.
Very good. Well done. Good. I approve. Well done.
Yay. Anyway, right, enough of that. Right, 2026 Formula One car, Zog, will be shorter by 20 centimetres, narrower by 10 centimetres. Their weight will be reduced by 30 kilograms to 768 kilograms. They're still going to have 18-inch tyres, but they will be narrower by 2.5 centimetres at the front and 3 centimetres at the rear. Downforce is down 30%. And we now have 50-50 power delivery between internal combustion engine and battery electric, and we have active aero. So how different are the cars looking now that we've seen, well, glimpses of them?
They're looking a little bit different, but, you know, not spectacularly so. I'm not, you know, there's no huge sea change in the look of cars, actually rather less than you might expect, given that there's actually quite a big change in aero. Like you say, this is the first year where we've got active aero. Now, active aero being aerodynamic surfaces, wings that are moved by actuators during the race. You know, they are reacting to conditions on the track, to what the driver wants to do, to increase drag, increase downforce, you know, whatever the car and the driver needs at that moment. This is a big change. Now, sure, that DRS is a kind of active aero. It's a little bit of active aero, but it's limited, and it was used in very particular circumstances during the race. This is, you know, anytime you want to use it, you can use it, and it's going to have a much greater effect on the racing.
There are two modes, aren't there? There's cornering mode and straight line mode. I think that's what they're calling it. But I have a slight query about it. I'm all for active aero. I love aerodynamics. I'm fascinated. I don't understand it all, but I care about it. And the idea that F1 cars being, you know, the very essence of the purity of motor racing, they should be able to trim their aero to maximise performance. But unlike DRS, where, you know, if you were the lead car, you didn't get DRS. Everyone behind you would if they were close enough. In this, there doesn't seem to be any advantage in the aero. If everyone is given the same ability to trim their aero for straight line speed or to create more downforce for cornering, then that's going to create kind of a stalemate, isn't it? And we're going to see fewer overtaking opportunities.
Well, let's see. Yeah, so many things are changing this year. Let's wait and see. That the aero regs, you know, as I understand it, are, you know, intended to minimise the problem of dirty air messing it up for the car following the car in front. But we'll see. Let's see what this season brings. But it does seem that quite a lot of the teams are anticipating that during the year, most of the gains they're going to be able to make, or most of what they'll be able to do, is in the aero side of the car's performance,
yeah,
as opposed to the chassis and the engine. But it's in the engine department that we've had some quite interesting news. The thing that got me very excited was the compression trick that Mercedes and apparently Red Bull have managed to pull off, which is one of those classic, you know, race car engineering tricks. It's reading the rules very closely and realizing that whatever the intention of the rules were, you know, if you just stick to the absolute letter of the rules, but use a bit more imagination, you can come up with an advantage over your rivals who are doing things kind of by the book and with less imagination. And the trick they are using is an expansion trick to get more compression, to get a higher compression ratio in their internal combustion engine cylinders. So it turns out that while there is a regulation that limits the compression ratio you can have in your engine, and that limit has gone down from 18 to 1 to 16 to 1 this year, so less compression, less power, Mercedes and apparently Red Bull realized that the rule about this compression limit was enforced by measuring the engines at ambient temperature.
Yeah.
Not the engines at working temperature.
Yep.
And so what they decided to do was simply build an engine that when you measure it at ambient temperature, at room temperature, it has a compression ratio of 16 to 1. But when you run the engine up to temperature, something, presumably the piston rods, expand enough that it changes the compression ratio in the engine. So you get back closer to the 18.1 that you were using last year.
Yeah, we've discussed this on the program previously in reasonable detail. But what you said there is right, that, you know, Ford and Mercedes are said to be using this to their advantage. However, was it someone from Toyota at the launch of the new Toyota, what's it called, the RA626, something like that, the motor that they're going to put in the Aston Martin? Someone from Honda.
Honda.
Yep, from Honda.
Yeah, Honda.
Yep, sorry, did I say something else?
It's a Toyota.
Oh, sorry. confusion will be my epitaph, as King Crimson once sang. So yeah, Honda say that they believe all F1 engine manufacturers will be using thermal expansion technology in some form or another anyway. Interesting. It's not quite as clear cut perhaps as we may have thought, and that there are other ways of enhancing performance using similar technology in different ways that are not yet even picked up by the rules and regulations. Hey, we don't know. Well, it's so exciting.
Oh, well, yeah, of course, yeah, everybody's going to be looking at any other similar trick they might be able to pull off. In my reading of what the Honda people had said at the launch, the way I read that was a little bit more suggesting that, yeah, there were various regulations that they were looking at to try and exploit in perhaps a similar way. But I didn't read that as suggesting that they were using a similar trick. I mean, I do think that, you know, it does look as if Mercedes and Red Bull have pulled out a bit of an edge here. There can be other stuff going on that will advantage other teams.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk about fuel mixtures again. There's some new bespoke fuels, aren't there? Shell, I think.
Well, they use the
doing good.
They have to use sustainable fuels this year. So the fuel regulations are different. And this, of course, is different to, I think, until the end of this year, they were using essentially pump fuel. You had to have fuel that was the same as fuel that would go into a road car. This year, I'm not sure quite how the fuel regs are different, but it is a different fuel. It's a sustainable carbon neutral fuel rather than pump fuel. There may be some room in the fuel mix to do a little bit of work to make that engine work a little bit better than that other engine. I suspect that what you can do on the fuel side of things is kind of trivial compared to what you can do with a trick like the compression ratio.
Yeah, that would make a significant difference, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I suspect that, you know, whatever Honda got their eye on, again, I think apart from directly affecting that compression ratio, I suspect the gains in other areas are going to be pretty small. But who knows? Let's see. We're not going to know until the first race. But it's not all doom and gloom for other engine manufacturers. I mean, Ferrari, for example, got their engine going quite early on and seemed to have, you know, a reliable engine working as they wanted pretty early on in the car development process. So they should have a solid basis to improve their engine and also to develop the whole package. Whereas, you know, often if you're starting out, particularly at the start of a new, you know, new engine formula and change of regs, you're often chasing some slightly basic things in the engine. If you've got a bit more vibration than you wanted, or you're just, you know, your temperature management isn't quite what you want, and you've got to spend a lot of the time that you would otherwise spend making the car quicker, you have to spend that time fixing some more basic reliability things. Whereas it looks like Ferrari are going to be able to get stuck solidly into making the car quicker.
Well, they've already got a car running on track, because remember the Cadillac, which I think is the only one of two cars that have run so far. The Audi has as well. The Cadillac's got that Ferrari,
Ferrari engine. Right.
Yeah. Audi have done their sort of installation television filming day with their motor. We don't know any more about it than that at this stage. And we're not going to as well, because the initial two tests are private tests, aren't they? The first ones of which are in Barcelona, I believe. They're technically a private test, but it isn't until we get to, is it Bahrain? They're doing the proper full season test, and there's going to be a huge curve of, you know, development between those two tests as well. They're throwing everything at it. Yeah, I'm reminded of the general advice that's given to production companies when making a TV series, right? You've got the first series, of a pitch that you've managed to get across the line, you've got to deliver it, and let's say you've got $10 million to make this whole season, right? You throw $5 million of that on the first episode. Right, you've got to get it across the line. Right, you worry about how you're going to make the rest of the season or the rest of the TV series with the budget you've got. Right, get that right. Throw everything at it. And that's the sort of situation I think we're in with F1 at the moment, because it's such a radical change. It's like you've got to come out of the blocks with a decent car. You've got to. Otherwise, you know, you're dead in the water. But it's exciting. Do you disagree?
Well, when you have such a big change of rules and regulations, it's very hard to come out of the blocks with, you know, the complete package.
Yeah.
None of the teams will have had as much time as they wanted to develop their cars. None of them are going to have the package that ideally they would want. And I think Aston Martin, for example, I think have indicated that they are not going to have what they regard as their 2026 car until sort of middle of the season. You know, they're going to start out with what they know is an interim package, and they're, you know, kind of building up towards being able to get the car they want around the middle of the season when they introduce, you know,
B-spec.
Yeah, a B-spec car later in the year, having had time to work on everything, presumably.
Yeah. I wonder how many finishes we're going to get at the first race. I wonder if more than half the grid will finish.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, for all kinds of reasons, the reliability of the cars has got so much better in recent years. Yeah. I would confidently bet, I should be careful, I'm making some slightly reckless F1 bets, it seems. I'm sure they are mostly going to finish in that first race. Would there be, what would be the number of non-finishers due to reliability?
Well, there's going to be 22 cars starting for the first time.
Yeah, yeah. No more than, maybe we'll have three cars not finishing that first race due to reliability. No more than that. I think I'm going to say
due to reliability.
Due to reliability. You know, other stuff can happen. Doesn't count if you get punted off. But I'm going to say maximum of three reliability non-finishes.
Well,
that's my
interesting to find out. Yes. Of the cars that we've seen so far, we've seen the Red Bull livery launch.
Yeah,
and we've seen the Haas launch. Very pleased to see loads of Ford Blue on the Red Bull. Ah, yeah.
But how much have they actually been involved in developing that car?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you were saying earlier that, you know, maybe Ford had, you know, found this trick in the engine. If anyone found a trick in that Red Bull engine, I think it's Red Bull, not Ford, because Ford have only come in relatively late. And, you know, all of the heavy lifting on that engine, I think, was done by the Red Bull bunch, not Ford.
Red Bull put a whole team of engineers together that they poached from other teams or, you know, made better offers to. And, they knew the spec and what was achievable. I did read that, was it Lauren Mekes said that Ford had been even more useful in the energy recovery battery and electric motor and software side of things than they were expecting. But yeah, who knows about the motor?
And that would make sense in terms of being an area of technology that Ford could probably really offer some valuable knowledge and technology and resources coming in a little bit later. You know, it's a distinctly different area, a distinctly, you know, kind of, well, I say discrete area of the whole package. Obviously, it all connects up. It all integrates in, you know, actually quite complicated ways. But nonetheless, you can see how there could be just some immediate benefits there of technology and knowledge that could be fed into the Red Bull development.
If I can quote Mike Peters' lyrics, back where we started from, and there's permanence in change, because Red Bull have got Ford engines again. Again, because in their debut season, they used the Cosworth block. I was checking it out. When was that? 2005 was their first season with Ford. I can't remember now.
They had been Jaguar.
Yeah, and then, here's a surprise, the year after, they dumped the Cosworth motors, gave them to Toro Rosso, and Red Bull used Ferrari engines for 1 year, and then the next year, they settled on Renault. So, man, three different engines in 3 years. Wow. Good luck to them back then.
Wow.
But, yeah, also, here's another thing about Red Bull. They've lost an awful lot of people recently, in terms of continuity. Who's gone, right? Christian Horner, Adrian Newey, Helmut Marko, Jonathan Wheatley, and Will Courtney as well. You know, there's always a churn in Formula One, but it does seem like some very, very key players, have left Red Bull. Let's hope that they've got the strength in depth to, you know, patch over that.
Yeah, my sense was that Lauren Mekes was doing a good job of rebuilding the team and getting it back going in the right direction last year, and I'm sure he's only going to continue that. So, yeah, at the same time, they have lost a lot of people that contributed to their past success. I think, nonetheless, they're on an upward curve at the moment. That said, I think Mercedes and McLaren are probably going to be the strongest teams at the start of the year. With all the unknowns that are in there, you know, we don't know just how strong, you know, Ferrari are actually going to be, just how strong Aston Martin might actually be at the start of the season, just what Williams might be able to put together with that probably very good, probably class of the field Mercedes engine.
Or Audi with their completely unknown engine technology again. I mean, fascinating. I'm confused though, Zog. I'm confused about Haas. Because I don't know if you followed this. They launched the Haas livery, and the team is now called Toyota Gazoo Racing Haas with a Ferrari engine, right? It doesn't quite make sense to me, that. But 24 hours later, I believe, Toyota announced that the WEC and Le Mans car was no longer going to be the Toyota Gazoo Racing GR010.
Yep.
It was now going to be the Toyota Racing TR10. And that they are kind of hiving off the Gazoo Racing brand to be its own brand, like Lexus or Toyota or Daihatsu within the Toyota empire. The rally team is still running it, and so are the Rally Raid team, who didn't win this year at Dakar. But come on, make up your mind, Toyota. Maybe because it's such a huge operation, it's going to take them a year or two to sort of unwind the rebranding.
Yeah, like you. No, I'm a bit confused. Haven't followed the ins and outs of it. Don't really understand what's going on there. But I think that's just, you know, maybe a little bit of not entirely stitched up, integrated thinking across the board of what, as you say, is a big organization, big company. There are a lot of moving parts there.
Despite being called Gaz at some point in my life, you know, you'd think I would have an affinity to the Gazoo Racing. Love Toyota. I owned a Toyota for 19 years, right? I never really warmed to the brand. Gazoo, for me, it either sounds like, you know, kazoo that you would blow, or Gaz's wazoo, you know, Gareth's anus.
Or one of the finest synth pop acts of all time, Yazoo.
Oh, Yazoo. And there was a character called the Great Gazoo in the Flintstones, some levitating alien or something.
Okay.
So I'm glad to be seeing the backside of Gazoo.
All right, yeah.
I mean that. I came out that way. I really am. Toyota Racing. So we'll see. I don't know. Who knows what Toyota's long, medium-term plans are with that brand, and has it got something to do with them separating their relationship in Formula One with their other racing activities and the road car brand? Who knows?
Who knows?
Who knows? Two things very briefly, Zog, before we wrap this, because I've got to leave time to talk to our Alex.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Two things I want to flag up, not only to our listeners, but to you as well, because I bet you'd love this. There's a YouTuber called Tom Scott, who does lots of engineering stuff, and he's great. And he asked a fundamental question about cars, which has been in my mind since about 1968 or something like that. And that is, if you were Captain Scarlet or Captain Blue driving the SPV, the Spectrum Pursuit Vehicle, this armoured car with a missile launcher and foldable tank tracks at the rear, caterpillar tracks at the rear, and you were driving it as they did, i.e. facing the back of the vehicle using a screen, is it actually possible to drive a real vehicle like that? He made a short video about it. They built a kind of a Dakar buggy that he sat backwards in and controlled with like a PlayStation steering wheel. Brilliant bit of work.
Yep.
And I'm not going to tell you what his conclusion was about it. I'd recommend going to see the film.
I'm going to go check this out. No, this sounds interesting. Okay, let's just have a think about this. I mean, first thought is, given that you're basically recreating the kind of setup that you might have with, well, you know, any kind of remote control for a vehicle.
Yeah, yeah.
Which might happen anytime that, you know, there could be various stunts in film or TV, for example, that might sometimes be set up with, you know, a radio-controlled operator for a car that is going to do something that's considered too dangerous for a person to be in.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and you can definitely operate that competently if you've got a screen and good controls remotely. But the thing is, what happens if you then take that control setup, stick it on the vehicle that you're controlling, but by flipping it in reverse, you're going to have sensory inputs that could confuse you as an operator. So, you know, exactly. You turn the wheel to the right, you know, maybe the sensory input that you're getting is the opposite to what you expect.
Yeah, yeah, your head goes the opposite way.
So, let me think.
My conclusion to this, I mean, I've kind of done this on a bike as well, Zog. I've actually ridden a bike on how a long time ago that was configured, you pedal and you ride backwards. And that was almost impossible.
Well, of course, and, you know, I think a lot of us have tried that. That classic thing with the bike with the controls backwards. I mean, I think it's an old fairground trick or, you know.
It
is impossible. Okay, having just thought about it a little bit and having that quick chat about it, here's my guess.
Yeah.
My guess is that he found it harder than driving it with controls facing forward, possible, but it was a little bit harder, basically somewhere in between bike and no effect. So bike, maximum effect, definitely messes you up. Somewhere in the middle. That's my prediction. Very safe prediction.
Spoilers. I think you nailed it there, Zeke.
Okay. Oh, well,
my solution, my addendum to the film, if I got to tack a bit on the end of this film, would be, okay, given that it was doable, but very, very tricky and certainly not an advantage other than in crashing, where if you want to crash, you want to crash backwards. That's why the reason was given for doing that, because the SPV would crash through buildings. And of course, if you're sitting backwards, that's a great way to survive it.
Yeah.
But I suggest what they do, because they were in this kind of airline seat, this fully enclosed seat, for the SPV, they would need to reverse stimulate the driver. You would need little things that press you in the right direction, the head and the chest and the side. And that would make it much more viable. I'm going to actually put a comment on his page, on the YouTube page, suggesting, right, next stage, do that.
Yeah, not about suggestion. However, I think the fact that you need to be doing this movement in the opposite direction to the impulse you're getting from the vehicle's natural motion, I think that means you'd need a much bigger space to do this in. So whatever kind of, you know, flight simulator seat rig you've got in the back of your SPV, you're going to need even more space to make it move.
Yeah, yeah.
Basically, they should just build in a bit more crash protection, I reckon. They've got, you know, if you've got all the space to do that, just a bit more crash protection. That seems to be the simplest solution. I don't know.
I'd love the imagination of science fiction in the 60s. You know, solving problems we didn't know we had, right? Beautiful.
Yeah, and Gerry Anderson did a great job.
Hero.
Great vehicles, great shows.
Absolute hero. That's it, Zog. We're going to leave you now. But one final thing. Go and look at that video by Tom Scott.
I will.
Also, go and look at a YouTuber called Tomo, who is currently redesigning all the liveries of the 2026 Formula One cars, as if, you know, they're nice, they're great, but he's got another spin on it.
Hey, he can do better.
Yeah, that's what he reckons.
Okay, I'll go and check it out.
Yeah, check it out.
I'll take a look. Good, thanks a lot.
See, speak to you in a fortnight when hopefully we are either just had or just about to have a trip to the moon.
Fantastic. Speak to you then.
Live long, prosper.
Captain Scarlet reporting for driver training, sir.
Welcome to the Spectrum Training Facility. I'm Commander Tangerine, your instructor for the day.
You look very like Captain Orange.
No, he's known as Captain Papaya now. Look, never mind all that, Scarlet. This is going to be your first time driving the Spectrum Pursuit vehicle, so remember, you're facing backwards. Now, jump in and take it for a careful first lap around the course. I'll talk to you from the pit wall.
S-I-G.
Yeah. No need for all that. Just get in. Okay, start it up. Okay, now, one careful lap around the course, Scarlet. Scarlet, slow down. You're going too fast. Watch out, you gotta turn left, I mean steer right! Tangerine to Scarlet, please respond. Tangerine to Scarlet, please respond.
I'm okay, I'm still breathing, but the SPV is a write-off.
Well, I've learned something today. Captain Scarlet, you may be indestructible, but the SPV certainly isn't.
I'm not going to keep him long because he's just got back in from a very, very hard day's work and he's jet-lagged and knackered and he is Alex Gore. You're right, bruv.
Hi. Yeah, I'm all right. I'm just in the very, very end bit of jet lag because I spent last week in China.
Wow, that's the second time you've been to China in like 3 months or 2 months.
Yes, it is. And I'm not sure I want to go back in a hurry, but it's a very long way away. It's a very long way away.
Yeah, I think it's always been where it is, though. I don't think they've moved it further or nearer. It's definitely where it always was.
I thought some pesky scamp had moved it another hour or so away on a plane because, you know, 12, 13, 14 hours, quite a long way. Depends who you're flying with. If you fly with China Eastern, you can go over Russia. If you don't, you can't.
Ah.
And that adds time.
You know that when you see a map, a global map, you always get Europe in the centre, America to the west, and Russia and China and everywhere else to the east. But if you buy a map in China, China is at the centre of your map and everything is east and west. Most countries do that. And I don't know what your understanding of Chinese is, or mine is very scant, but what I do know is the Chinese character for China translates as at the centre of the world. It's like a square with a vertical line through it. That means we are the centre of the world. Isn't that romantic?
Well, that's very nice.
Yeah, I genuinely like that. There are lots of things about China that are wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And there are one or two things about China that are little disturbing to a lot of people.
Less wonderful, yes.
On balance, who were you there with?
I was there with Geely, so... We've talked about Geely a lot, but only as a sort of owner or investor in companies. So it owns Volvo and Polestar and LEVC and Lotus and plenty of others. But it's just launched in the UK as its own brand. So Geely launched with the EX5, which is an EV, which has some range and is sort of quick. And it's about to launch something called the Starray EMI, which is a hybrid. And you can get it with two types of battery and all this. And we were supposed to be driving another new Geely while we were out there, but that didn't appear, which was irritating. But while we were there, we had a go in the Starray. It was fine.
I like that name.
I don't, but might just be because I'm tired. So it's very sweet. It's got like the design is fairly nice. It's very aero. It's very aero led because they want to be as economical as possible. And the interior's got big screen and some nice design bits on it. And it's comfy and it's quick. Ish. And it steers okay. Steering's not the sharpest in the world, and when the battery runs out, the petrol motor kicks in and it's a bit growly, but so are all PHEVs. I mean, some of them are whisper quiet, but this one's a little bit on the growly side. But we were also there, so as these trips to China are, these press trips, it's sort of a go and have a look at stuff and a little bit of an indoctrination trip of look at how great we are, we're the best company ever.
Yep.
And so that was part of it. So we were a small group and we bounced around from place to place to place, interviewed people, saw their head office in Hangzhou, I think it was, which is a massive skyscraper in the middle of town. 6,000 people work there. It's insane.
Wow.
But the most interesting bit is they took us to their safety centre and wind tunnel, which sounds incredibly dry, but it's sort of a stats-packed thing. So it opened at the tail end of last year. It's a massive, massive area of where all this is. And the safety centre, if you know, you see that crash footage from Euro NCAP, of cars ramming into walls and such.
Yeah.
They've basically built their own facility to do that. They've got a 100-metre square columnless room with a big brick in it and some sleds to throw cars at. Looking at some of my notes here, they can lob a 3.5-tonne car at said brick at up to 120 kilometres an hour, which is quite fast when you think about it. And they can simulate all sorts of crashes and events, so you can have it sort of in a head-on or being hit in the side or corner to corner, as most crashes are. And they can do loads of stuff with it. And in the same room, they've got one of those sort of mist chambers. Don't remember years and years and years ago when autonomous emergency braking was a new thing, and Mercedes said, well, we can turn this system on and we can drive it in the fog and our car won't crash into the back of something else. And they turned on the fog in the big tunnel and they launched an S-Class straight into the tunnel, where it immediately accordioned with another S-Class that had been parked there. And it was all very embarrassing
because
they forgot
to
turn it on.
Oh,
it was brilliant.
No.
Volvo had something similar as well. Where they go, oh, it's definitely not going to have an accident, and then it very much did because someone forgot to press a button somewhere or whatever. But they've got their own version of one of those, so it's a giant sort of cage thing. And while we were there, they showed us a Zeekr, I think it was, one of those sort of more luxury posh brands, being driven at speed towards a simulated cyclist, not an actual one, it was a sort of a bike on a stick with a bloke on it, and it did its emergency stop and no one died, and it was all very impressive. But the thing about it is that the whole safety centre, it's kind of mad. So they've got like 40 crash test dummies of their own design that simulate tall people, short people, men, women, Europeans, Asians,
Americans,
babies, children. So they've got the whole kind of gamut of people there. The fleet of crash test dummies is like £2 million. Because they're all full of sensors and they're very special and they're very advanced and they're this and they're that. And it was quite eerie to see them, because we were walked around a sort of walkway with windows into all these rooms. We weren't allowed to take any pictures of our own, but there are some out there. And there's just rows and rows of these faceless sort of people dressed in crash suits and all that. It was very odd.
Do you have any concern that these people may be sentient?
The chance of autons being real is low, but never zero.
So,
there could have been an auton invasion. But at least while they were murdering us, they could accurately measure the force and impact of every strike around our heads until it went pop. So they could formulate the perfect winning blow speed for a human skull.
You said you were outside this cage and able to watch the auton invasion get saved by autonomy. It strikes me as not necessarily kind of a lecture theatre or theatrical environment in which you might have testing thing.
So it's kind of, without diagrams that aren't entirely to scale, it's a little bit difficult to describe. But when we walked in, we were taken up some stairs and we were sort of paraded along a walkway that had lots of infographics on the wall, and they had windows into various rooms. So there was the room full of the autons, There was the cybersecurity room, which looked weirdly like a Bond villain's lair because the back of it was just a big screen with the world on it.
Yeah.
And you could press a button and it would flash red and they'd be like, now we're simulating a cyber attack.
And I bet that world had China at the centre of it.
I believe it did, yes. But that room, it was basically to demonstrate that in that room is where they do all the techie stuff and like plug it into laptops and do various simulations of what could happen if, and is this software vulnerable in any way, etc., etc., etc. At least that's what the guide said. And then they took us through to a sort of auditorium lecture theatre looking thing with a desk at the front and loads of seats concertinaed up. And he turned around and pressed a button and then some of the wall became see-through and that was the view of the massive room. So they could show people crash tests happen in real time without people being in the room. So you could like turn around and watch it. The AEB thing, we were in the room for it. But it's just a massive space. It's enormous.
Were you in the future while you were over there slightly?
It was a little bit. Sorry, I was wrong about the dummies. They were nearly 60, so say my notes. And Geely apparently was the first to develop an Asian body type for a crash test dummy. There you go.
Intriguing.
And they're kept in a temperature and humidity controlled room.
Bless them.
And yeah, they've got 3D scanning in there so they can see exactly what happens to these things. And the amount of money they've thrown at it. So at this safety centre is something like 200 million for that and the wind tunnels. They were showing us like, but yeah, we can make sure that our cars, when they go into test, they won't fail because we would have worked out all the kinks. Oh yeah, also in this room, they can simulate fog, sleet, snow and bright sun. So they can try and blind the cameras in various different ways as they would be in various different places in the world.
I'm intrigued as to why this is what they've focused on this trip. You know, if they're targeting, look how safe we are, we test and crash, is that because they believe the perception of people who are buying the Chinese cars or Geely's cars could be unsafe? The cybersecurity thing, is that to allay fears about Chinese access to networks?
To be honest, I think it's one of those things, because Geely's got so much going on, and there are so many cars, it strikes me as one of those things where they seem to have all of the money, like all of it, which is why these brands are coming out kind of all guns blazing with amazing deals, because they can afford to not make much on them to start with, right? They just decided that that's what they wanted to do, so they could just do it themselves. And then when they need to do a crash test, an official one, they can just be like, right, fine, yeah, that'll do it, definitely. Quids in. They were saying that they can do 1,800 crash tests a year if they work 24/7 shifts.
Interesting. Do you know, I remember reading a thing recently that European car makers, maybe Renault, had observed that they were going to try and start manufacturing cars using the quick turnaround process that you find in China these days. China specializes in really churning them out at great volume and very, very quickly from idea to road, and that Europe was going to try and benefit from copying this.
We had a factory tour in Linai, I believe it's like, I'm probably butchering the pronunciation of the names. And the factory tour was kind of fascinating because you've been to car factories, I've been to car factories. Mm-hmm. They are either incredibly interesting because you've never seen one before, mm-hmm. or it's a car factory.
Yeah.
Where flat bits of metal go in and cars go out. And it's like, oh, there's an automated line. There's another automated line. There are some people. Ooh, isn't this exciting? But the thing about the one we were at, that factory is massive. I can't remember the size of it, but it's enormous. And it's there purely to build the Staray EMI. But the rate they can churn them out is just insane. Like, it's mental. You were seeing these people manning machines. Like, it wasn't like, say, the Porsche factory in Leipzig, which I've been to before. And there are loads of people on the lines and they're individually putting things on and doing this and doing that. What we saw there was more machines and people making sure that the machines were doing their job.
Yeah.
Now, another one of their factories makes the Geely EX2, which is coming to the UK later in the year. It's a small electric hatchback. Over there, it has a local name, but it's the biggest selling car in China. It's £6,000 local. So you can see why.
Yeah.
But they sell 50,000 a month.
Yeah, and it's been this for a good few years now, hasn't it? It was like a major breakthrough where they built a short range, economical, lightweight, cheap, city and urban EV, and bang. China could afford it, and China went for it, didn't it, in a big way.
Yeah, they sell 50,000 a month. To put it into perspective, I've used this stat in a story, which is why it's close to hand. Mini, last year, sold, of the Cooper family, so that's the five-door, the three-door, and the convertible, about 169,000 cars globally. And they sell 50,000 of these a month in China.
Which is why they've got a 50-story high skyscraper with 6,000 people working in it.
6,000 people in it.
That's why.
I mean, it's just mad. The one thing that kind of got me about it is they showed us a concept of something that was going to be basically a Defender rival, but for less money and with a Geely badge on it. And they said, well, this shares a chassis or a platform with this and this and this. And what Geely's doing is it's got all these brands, some we know, some we don't, some are theirs entirely, some are legacy brands. But they're sort of turning themselves into a bit of a Stellantis, but with more advanced tech and fewer Italians. So what I worry about, having seen it all and having sort of been given the full indoctrination tour, there are lots of cars with all the whiz bangs. There was a big Zeekr thing that was basically two armchairs with a 70-inch plasma screen in the back and then someone up front drives. Very, very luxurious and very delightful. But they say, this is based on that, and this is based on that, and this is based on that. And you just go, okay, so you've got Lotus, which is a sporty one, and that'll be share a platform with that one over there, which is a more sort of premium-y luxury one. And then that's going to be a Defender, but that's going to be a Geely brand. And you're going to end up with sort of, this is going to have that because of those, because it's got that underneath it, and it's just a different body shell dropped on top and a different badge. A little bit like, say, the Alfa Romeo toenail thing, which underpins a bunch of other SUVs from Citroën and Peugeot and all that lot. So I think the way they're doing it, for the UK at least, is kind of smart, because they've got Lotus, which is the sporty one with the EV that no one's really buying.
Yep.
They've got Volvo, which is the posh one, which is sort of doing okay, but they're still selling the old product as well to bolster it, which is a good idea. Mm-hmm. And then LEVC, obviously, they were saying that because the company's been around in the UK for so long, they basically took a load of their business practices to better understand the UK market.
Polestar as well.
Obviously, that was sort of a Volvo spin-off, and lots of it, the early days, you know, the Polestar 2 is based on a Volvo automotive chassis that's been heavily modified. But the latest stuff, some of it, like Polestar's chassis, they're all a bit different at the moment. They all come from different places. So the Polestar 3 and the Polestar 4 kind of look the same size-ish, but they're very different underneath,
right,
even though they have similar sort of UI and architecture-y bits that you and I would look at. But underneath, the bits are different.
And they've got other brands as well. Lincoln Co. in Europe, not in the UK, but
Lincoln Co. Lincoln, yeah, that's sort of Nordic-y, isn't it? But yeah, those also, I mean, whether they're going to launch here, I don't know. Zeekr, they were saying, is going to launch here, which again is all very luxurious. I think I drove one last year. And we were saying, when's it coming to the UK? And they went, don't know. But we've been told it's now. But the one thing that kind of got me, we had a roundtable interview with a bunch of execs. And we were asking, like, how are you going to scale this? And what if there's tariff worries? And what if there's this? And what if there's that, right? They took a bunch of cars over to CES so some US journalists could have a go in them. And someone said, you want to launch here. How are you going to do it? And they went, we have a Volvo plant in South Carolina.
Right. Yeah.
We'll just use that to make the cars here. So it was put to them that perhaps, you know, if they wanted to build a car locally in the UK, if tariffs appeared, what would they do? And they didn't say they wouldn't retool Hethel.
Oh, really? Oh, my God. Well, they've got a lot of spare capacity at Hethel. Let's be honest.
Yeah, I know. But it's an interesting thing because, like, he said that there were lots of ifs and buts to it. Like, you need to have demand for one. Mm-hmm. There needs to be an actual need for it. The finances need to work and that needs to work. But Geely, if it needs to, could quite happily go, fuck it, Norfolk.
Yeah.
We'll start churning out EX2s or EX5s or whatever at Hethel.
Having said that, the way in which Lotus build cars is quite different to how you produce mass volume vehicles, which is why they're so expensive and why they've not succeeded. But it's a very specialist manufacturer. All they've really, it's wrong to say all they've got there, but what they have there is a very large empty building if they want to gut out what used to be the Evora line.
Yeah.
But they have, you know, a bunch of very, very skilled workers, who not quite production line workers, so it's not quite the way Lotus works. They've got that, but they'd have to strip it out and start again. But it could happen. Hey, is that better than Lotus just going under? I mean, in terms of the workforce, anyway.
Lotus going under, I don't think they'll let it happen.
Right, good.
They're working on a hybrid version of the Emeya and the Electra, which, you know, would certainly give them new life.
Yeah.
Whether or not they'd be exciting, who knows? But, you know, you can get a lot of power out of a hybrid powertrain. It's nice and easy. Well, I say easy. I'm not an engineer. But engineers seem to be good at doing it.
They're the best people to do it. Listen, we got to wrap this because I want to let you go to bed, man, because I know how wiped out you are.
I need to do a sleep. I'm like 4 days out, but I landed on Friday night and then didn't sleep a wink to the Saturday. I had like a few hours on the plane, so I was running on like 35 hours of no sleep or whatever it was. And then slept like a log on Saturday. Sunday, very little sleep. Last night, just about. So, getting there.
Well, while you're semi-conscious, I sort of throw two brief things at you for a reaction.
Yep.
First one is that, not Geely, but one of the others, Chery, announced this week that their Leapfeng Exceed will be the first car on the market with a completely solid-state battery with an incredible performance. They describe it as a shooting brake. I wouldn't. I'd call it a wedge or a sporting long hatch.
I mean, lots of people throw shooting brake around willy-nilly and don't know the true meaning of what they're on about.
How dare they? As the official authority on this matter in the UK.
Indeed, indeed.
Come back to it. Yeah, man, which I'm very interested in. You know, China is knocking it out of the park at the moment. They're ahead of everybody else in many ways. Not all, but the rest of the planet has to sit up and notice and up their game to keep up with them. It's all on cost. It's not all on cost. It's on cost and it's on technological brilliance, to be honest. They're pretty good at it over there, aren't they? And the other one, I bet you know about this, a new Jensen, open inverted commas, Interceptor, close inverted commas.
So I saw that. It broke while I was away, but I saw that. The thing is, I don't know the people that make it, but if they are the people I think they are, which is Jensen Automotive International or something.
That's
like that.
Correct. That's who it is.
So they're based up sort of Midlandsy way.
Banbury.
And they've been Jensen specialists forever. So they know what they're doing around Jensen engines, but they also do the Chieftain Range Rover, which are sort of resto modded ranges. They'll put a V8 in it, obviously. They built someone a hybrid Range Rover Classic, and they also built a to order, so a customer asked for it and asked them to do it, an electric conversion, which I drove 2 years ago now, and it was quite good. And I had a nose around their workshop, and they just like making cool stuff go fast.
Yeah, but what they do as opposed to what they're planning to do, and that is design, engineer, conceive a completely new GT inspired by the Interceptor, is a very different thing altogether. This is going to be one of those cars which you might just get a prototype, or you might build and sell a few. I hope I'm not dooming this project by saying this, but I just can't see them getting it across the line. It is so difficult to make cars these days and a profit, isn't it?
I mean, the really interesting thing is the chap who runs it, whose name completely escapes me, he's an old school engineer, proper old school engineer. And I was interviewing him about how the UK became like the EV resto mod capital of the world.
Yeah.
And what he was saying was like, what we do and what we've always done is we've found a problem. We've then all got down in our little offices and we figured out how to do it on a small to medium-ish scale.
Yeah.
And then we've waited for someone else, because there's NAFL government support and there's NAFL this and there's NAFL that, to pick it up and run with it.
Correct.
So from the stuff that they've done, so from the Chieftain stuff and the things they do with Interceptors already, I think they're in a good place because they've got the nous to do it and they've got the business sense to do it because they're smart guys. They wouldn't have gone, oh, we'll just see what happens. I mean, obviously, it could very happily spiral out of wild control and cause fires everywhere. But, I mean, it's one of those things, like, having spent time with them, I can see why they're confident in doing it. Whether or not it actually works, I mean, I'm sure I can fabricate an edible hat. I've got faith they'll shift at least a couple.
That's almost exactly what I was saying. They're going to shift one or two. That'll be it. Alex, it's lovely to end on agreement. We seldom disagree.
This is true. You're a very agreeable human being.
As you are too. And thank you for being agreeable to come on the show despite your utter exhaustion. You're a lovely man, brother.
Sorry I made you wait late. I was on a launch today that I can't talk about until next time.
Can you tell us what it was?
I can't. Well, I posted a picture of it on my Twitter. But yeah, I was playing in big off-road things today.
Which is something we'll come back to in another episode of On Speed. But for now, Alex, thank you very much, brother.
Welcome. Love you. Bye.
Bye.
If you enjoyed this show, then please like, share and subscribe. For information on how to contact the show, see pictures, read song lyrics, follow us on social media, or to sponsor this podcast, go to garethjones.tv. Gareth Jones on Speed is made in Wales by Whiz Bang.
Gareth Jones on Speed!